The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
And welcome to The Upgrade, the podcast from the team at Lifehacker, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Alice Bradley, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And I'm Virginia Smith, Lifehacker's managing editor.
And today we're talking about how to talk to people you don't agree with.
Something a number of us find ourselves having to do this Thanksgiving.
I don't know what you're talking about, Virginia. Melissa and I spoke to Jonathan Haidt, social psychologist and author of The Coddling of the American Mind, about campus culture and the importance of being willing to be exposed to opinions you, well, hate.
I'm saying we need to give less offense, take less offense, and pass on less offense.
We'll also be chatting with Anil Dash, blogger, entrepreneur, and technologist, about how we should treat each other despite our differences, both online and in real life.
Right. I mean, these days, they fly their troll flag. They have an avatar with whatever meme of the day indicates that I'm acting in bad faith.
Then, writer and theorist Andra Mejia will give us 5 steps for how to defuse a Thanksgiving Day fight.
The kids are bickering. Have them run to the top of the house to bring back something from the attic.
Yeah, the best way to do that is not to go home.
Oh.
Yeah, my hack is to walk away.
Yeah, well, how do you deal with Facebook conflicts with friends and family?
I've mostly stopped engaging. My answer to everything is to not engage.
Yeah.
I try not to do it unless there's a really good reason to. I prefer to talk to people in person or not pile on. Mm-hmm. I don't always hold myself to this rule, but one of our staff writers, Nick Douglas, had a really good post recently titled, "Ask Yourself This Question Before You Get Into an Argument Online." And the question is if your response or engaging is going to be strategic or just cathartic. Mm-hmm. So if I want to scream at someone just because, you know, we disagree about Bernie versus Hillary still in the year of our Lord 2018, usually that's not going to be a strategic move,
yeah.
For instance.
And I think recognizing that there's something really enjoyable about that catharsis, you know, like I think we can fool ourselves into thinking like, I'm doing good here. I'm just letting it out. But in fact, it's kind of fun to be self-righteous.
Right. It's like everyone is a troll except for me. But no, you have it. We all have a little troll lurking in there.
We've all got a little troll in us. Happy Thanksgiving.
And to you.
Before we get into the show, we wanted to remind you that we are doing our first ever live recording of The Upgrade in Brooklyn at the Bell House on November 29th. Doors open at 6:30. Show starts at 7:30. It's going to be a great show. The theme is How to Fail. Our guests are comedian Chris Gethard, comedian Akilah Hughes, and Brittany Luce and Eric Eddings from Gimlet's The Nod podcast. Go to thebellhouseny.com to get your tickets. Please come. You have to be at least 21, and you have to be able to get yourself to New York because we're not paying for your ticket to get here.
Seems fair.
Yeah. And now it's time for the interview, where we interview someone. This week, Melissa and I spoke to Jonathan Haidt, social psychologist and co-author of The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. Jonathan argues that campus culture is reducing Gen Z's ability to engage with different opinions, making them more anxious and more prone to take offense.
So, John, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure, Melissa.
Tell us about what contributed to your writing of The Coddling of the American Mind.
So I'm a social psychologist. I study morality and politics and why people are so insanely divided. And I wrote a book called The Righteous Mind back in 2012, back when it seemed like America was impossibly divided. And in 2014, my friend Greg Lukianoff came to me. He's the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. And he said, John, weird stuff is happening on college campuses. Greg had been defending free speech for college students since around 2000. And it had always been the administrators who were trying to impose free speech zones and speech codes and all sorts of things. And he said, suddenly, around 2013, 2014, students started asking for protection from words. That's when the New Republic had a first article on trigger warnings. We started hearing about students asking for safe spaces. Students were reacting very strongly to books and speakers and individual words. And here's the key thing. They were not saying this is wrong. They were saying this is dangerous. And that was new. And so Greg was very puzzled by this because he had suffered from a suicidal depression in 2007. He learned cognitive behavioral therapy in 2008. He learned to name like 15 different distortions, you know, catastrophizing, labeling, discounting the positive. And suddenly, he said in 2013, 2014, students were doing exactly the cognitive distortions that he had learned not to do. If this person is allowed to speak, it will be a catastrophe and people will die. And so Greg came to talk to me because I'm a psychologist and he's not. And he said, you know, what do you think of my theory here that somehow we're teaching them to think in distorted ways? And I said, oh my God, you're right. Because I'd begun to see some traces of this too.
And what happened in 2013 or what happened in 1995 when these children were born?
Yeah, that's the key thing. When you see a complex sociological phenomena emerging, you know, in year X, you don't want to ask, well, what happened in year X? Mm-hmm. When we wrote the article in 2015, we thought that these were millennials, that college students were millennials. You know, most people thought millennials were born 1982 to maybe 2000 or 1998. But there's a book by Jean Twenge, a social psychologist at the University of San Diego, and it's full of graphs of how behavior changes year by year of teenagers. And what she shows is that kids born in 1995 are just really different. It's as sharp a cutoff as birth year 1946. You know, after the war, there's a huge baby boom, and they're raised in a different environment. And in the same way, kids born in 1996 or five are raised in a different environment than kids born in the early 90s. The big thing being, obviously, social media comes in when they're around 13. So they're the first people in history to be connected to each other all the time at the age of 13. Now, most of us can remember how awful it was to be in junior high school. Imagine if you couldn't even get away from it on the weekends. Imagine if you're always connected, and if you don't pay attention, others are talking about you. And so we think this is one of the major reasons why the anxiety and depression rates are so high, especially for girls. Boys are doing worse. Their suicide rate is up 25% compared to the first decade of the century. But girls are doing a lot worse.
Wow.
And so just draw the line for us. Connect the dots from these young people that grew up and had social media in their teens and then go on to college and are requesting safe spaces and trigger warnings.
Yeah. So objectively speaking, the world gets safer and safer. In the 1990s, just as we were beginning to lock our kids up and not let them play outside because we thought they'd be snatched, in the 1990s, the world's actually getting very safe. The crime rate is plummeting. But kids are now having online lives in which they are immersed in all kinds of hateful speech, you know, hostility, racial slurs, all sorts of nasty stuff. But also, they can mute things. They can block things. They get to select what they're exposed to. Now, imagine you come to college and there's a speaker coming. Why can't I mute him? So there are a variety of connections between being raised in a social media environment and then wanting to control your environment on campus.
So you identify something in the book you call the three untruths. Can you explain what those are?
Sure. So my first book was called The Happiness Hypothesis. And what I did there was I read all the wisdom literature I could find, extracted every psychological claim, and evaluated whether it was true or not. And then Greg comes to me and he says, you know, they're acting like a little tiny thing's going to kill them. And well, actually, chapter four of the Happiness Hypothesis is based on the dictum, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. That's what Nietzsche said, and you find it in the wisdom literature of China, all over the world. And the idea of microaggressions, the idea that words are violence, it's a direct contradiction of ancient wisdom. So the book is based on the three main terrible ideas that we see circulating on college campuses since 2014. So principle number one, what doesn't kill you makes you weaker. So avoid unpleasant experiences. Principle number two, or bad idea number two, always trust your feelings. That might sound nice. That might sound, you know, like, oh, the heart is so wise. But in a university setting, what you most need to learn is critical thinking. And if you start out arguing in support of what you feel, and everybody does that, all there is mutual incomprehension and anger. There's no progress. And the third one is life is a battle between good people and evil people. This is like the human default view. This is what people naturally believe. We're really, really good at being tribal. That was the theme of The Righteous Mind. So if you take these three terrible ideas and you teach them to kids, then they're very unlikely to have successful lives. They're very unlikely to have a sense of their own agency, a sense that they can act upon the world, a sense that the world is open to them, is not always hostile to them. So these are basically crippling ideas. Now, we're not saying that most kids believe them. We're not saying that most universities are teaching them. It's a minority of students in each in schools that are picking this up. It depends on the courses they take, their major. But we think these are terrible ideas, and we're trying to call attention to them.
You said that, you know, the ancients knew nothing of microaggressions and didn't teach that they were in any way dangerous. Microaggressions, you know, for me, it's a word that's come up certainly within the past 10 years, if not like the last 5 years. And it seemed to put a name on something that was happening, but nobody had ever named before. And once it was named, then we had a way to talk about it and we had a way to describe the effects that it was having. So, of course, the ancients weren't talking about microaggressions, but is it a bad thing that we finally find a way to articulate something that feels uncomfortable or feels bad or that looks like it's faulty about society?
So you're right that the microaggression concept labels something that didn't have a good name before. And so if we just focused on explicit racism and sexism, those are way down by every measure. Those are way down. But people can still say and do things that are really insensitive. So the word microaggression, it goes back to, Chester Pierce was his name in the 70s. But it was especially popularized by psychologist Daryl Wing Su in a 2007 article. It's a useful term if it literally meant microaggression. So if it was a veiled attempt to humiliate someone, well, that would be a very useful term. And we should certainly teach our students to not do that and to recognize that. The problem is that there's a whole nother category of things that are not bad intended, that are not malicious. In fact, as microaggressions are defined, they're often attempts to be helpful. So we need a word for that. Well, we have one. It's called faux pas. Okay, we don't have it in English. We had to borrow the French word because we really need it. People make a lot of stupid mistakes. And if you imagine trying to assemble a multicultural international community, as we do at New York University, as we do in every university, the more diversity you have, the more people are going to make mistakes and the more you need to train them to be more sensitive. But here's the thing. Do we teach everyone to recognize these faux pas and avoid them? Or do we teach everyone to consider them acts of aggression? This is the crucial line.
And what's an example of an actual, something that you would define as a microaggression?
Oh, so, if you're an African-American student, I hear this from a lot of Black students, people sometimes touch their hair. That's really bad. That's inappropriate. A lot of microaggressions are motivated by curiosity. So if you don't look visibly one of the major races, people are biracial, they often get the question, well, what are you? That could be a drag. I totally get that. But do we want to tell students that they should feel offended by that? Or do we want to tell students, look, people are curious. They will ask you all kinds of questions. We're going to try to reduce the degree to which people do that. Don't take it as an act of hostility. Now, of course, it's possible that someone's asking you because they hate your race. But for the most part, in a college community, people are pretty open.
Aren't microaggressions often the result of unconscious bias? So it's not an overt act of hostility, but maybe something that the perpetrator isn't even conscious of?
Well, first of all, the research on implicit bias is really complicated. And while there are implicit associations, those are not linked to behavior, it turns out. So if you know someone's implicit association scores, you don't actually know that they're going to discriminate. People do have stereotypes for sure. And if people could have unconscious hostility, maybe things are related to that. But when things are ambiguous like that, should we teach people to give the worst reading or the best reading? My kids are biracial. My wife is Korean. They look really interesting. They're gorgeous children. And people occasionally ask them, or they're still pretty young, but people will ask them. And I tell them, people are curious. It's not, just tell them you're half Jewish, half Korean.
Speaking about touching somebody's hair, don't you feel like that's a really well-known thing? Like, you don't do that, right? That people should know that because it's been talked about quite a lot, in addition to just being, it seems sort of obvious.
But not if you're in an incredibly international place like NYU. Mm-hmm. So you have people from all over the world, different social classes. What I think we should do at every school is do a survey every year. What are the kinds of things that you just wish people would stop? What are the indignities you face? And then the next year, we teach incoming students, you know, here's what the LGBT students say. Here's the things you should avoid. Like, so I'm not saying, oh, you know, members of historically marginalized groups just suck it up and give people the benefit of the doubt. I'm saying we need to give less offense, take less offense, and pass on less offense. Social media is a big culprit in all of this because we are all now drowning in stories.
I'm wondering if you don't hear complaints that this sounds like someone from a different generation criticizing young people and saying, you know, your feelings aren't valid. Yep. I know, you know, I'm a psychologist. I know that, you know, this doesn't have to be a microaggression. You could look at this thing differently and sort of in some way invalidates that experience of somebody who grew up in a totally different environment from you because they grew up with social media and because they grew up not being allowed to play outside.
That's a perfectly fair criticism. Every generation going back at least to Roman days has thought that the young generation doesn't have the virtues that it has. And so there surely is some of that going on. And if the signs were that this generation is doing fine, it's just that, you know, older white guys like me think that they don't have the virtues now. But because the mental health stats on iGen or Gen Z are so terrible, I do feel comfortable saying, this isn't just me kvetching about kids being different. There's a mental health crisis for teenagers, especially for teenage girls. Something's going terribly, terribly wrong. We have a major therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy. It's the best validated therapy out there. Kids are very largely contradicting exactly what it says to do. They would benefit from changing their thinking, and here's how they can do that.
In a recent episode, we had Dr. David Burns.
Oh, excellent. He wrote the book Feeling Good.
Exactly.
That's how I first learned CBT.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, for those who need a refresher from that episode, if you might sort of just give us a brief outline and some examples of the distorted thinking.
Sure. So the number one greatest truth of all of human history is that we don't respond to the world as it is. We respond to the world as we interpret it. CBT was developed by Aaron Beck, a psychiatrist at the University of Pennsylvania in the 1960s, who basically took these Stoic and Buddhist insights and put them into practice. He discovered that when he helped depressed people to question their negative assumptions, they would have at least a brief moment of relief from those symptoms. Now, they'd go right back into their distorted thinking, but he found that if he trained them over a course of a few weeks to catch their distortions, then the depression lifted. He didn't have to go back and work out their sexual fixation on their mother when they were three or something like that, as the Freudians said. And so David Burns studied with Aaron Beck, and he wrote this best-selling book. It's a wonderful book. It's very easy to read, called Feeling Good. Here, we're on Lifehacker. If you have any problems with depression, anxiety, relationships, go buy David Burns' book, Feeling Good. Read that. It'll help you deal with life. If every incoming student read David Burns' Feeling Good and Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People, campus life would be so much more fun.
I'm curious what you think, and if you sort of align yourself with people like Jordan Peterson and people of the so-called intellectual dark web who are being extremely rational and speaking, you know, what they declare to be rational truths and are getting a lot of pushback, certainly from liberals, for seeming to want to discount the experience of feelings. You're making a really good intellectual point, and you're building an argument, and you're sort of choosing your words carefully, and you're putting forth a plan or advice for how we can stop kids from being so fragile.
Mm, that's what a social scientist should do.
Exactly. So what I worry is that in lesser hands, it becomes this blunt object that's used by the alt-right, or it's used in sort of the darkest corners of Reddit to justify arguments that maybe don't have strong scientific backing necessarily. I feel like when we have a psychologist, we have a scientist, we have people who are really thinking these things through and putting forth these ideas, and then in lesser hands or sort of with less discerning minds, they're sort of used for ill.
So in a civil society, there are different zones of activity, and each zone of activity has its own norms. If you're in a hospital or in a doctor's office, it's governed by the ancient practice of healing, and everyone's thinking, what's wrong with this person? How can we heal them? Now, sometimes those zones become infected by the commerce norms. How can we get the most money from this person? So that's a corruption of the healing ethos. In a court of law, it's about justice and truth. And that could be corrupted. If a judge has stock in a private prison system, that would be horrible. And they say, oh, let's convict him because I get money. So that's corruption. Every zone of expertise, they need their own norms, and they have their own kinds of excellence and their own kinds of corruption. In a university, what we're trying to do, what our telos or purpose or goal is discovering truth. And that's why we are together in this way, specifically to challenge each other. We all suffer from confirmation bias. Universities are these amazing inventions that put us together in a community that is responsive to truth and that can make demands on each other to back up what we say. It works brilliantly, unless we get corrupted. We're not corrupted by money very much. That plays very little role in the daily life of scientists and social scientists, especially. There's not much we do that's really useful financially. I suppose that's not true. But the real corruption we have is that people begin thinking using the norms of the public square, which is, I'm on the left, I hate the right is dangerous, there are Nazis on the right. I better not write this thing if it could help them. That's actually corruption. That's actually the danger of political correctness. If you start thinking that way and you start warping research, what happens? What's actually happening is that some of those people on the alt-right, they read scientific papers. They actually sometimes know the research. They can use it against you. And then they get to claim that there's a conspiracy, that the academics can't be trusted. So you might have some small victories in suppressing information or in spinning your findings in ways that are not really what they say. You might have small victories, but man, you're destroying the whole enterprise. You're destroying the credibility of the sciences and of universities. You're not helping your cause in the long run.
How do you feel about that? I mean, can you speak to how you feel about it personally? If your book is being stripped of its nuance and used by these groups as kind of, you know, wielding it as a club instead of a something more sophisticated than a club.
A scalpel.
Scalpel, yes.
Well, first of all, I don't think that that's happening, but let's suppose that it does. This is a big society with a lot of people in it. Some of the people have views that I think are nasty. Am I going to reorganize my life because some of them do this? Okay, I'm Jewish. My parents raised me to believe that America is the promised land for the Jews. There was anti-Semitism when my grandparents came here. There was anti-Semitism when my parents were growing up. There was a trace of it when I was growing up, and there's hardly any now. All right, fine. So the Nazis march in Charlottesville. I lived there for 17 years. I love that town. A couple hundred people march in Charlottesville. Am I going to suddenly say, oh my God, I was wrong. America's really anti-Semitic. Oh my God, what a terrible country. Not at all. Not at all. The country was revolted by it. One person at the very top of the country was not, and that was horrible, but he was rejected by a lot of people, even in the military and business. So one thing, a big problem we have is that social media has allowed us to all know about single episodes. What is the number of anti-Semitic episodes in this country below which I will say America's in great shape? You know, is it 10,000 a day, 100,000 a day? I don't know what it is, but it's, you know, if I hear about a few, I'm not going to say, oh my God, I was wrong. This is a great country to be an immigrant, to come from somewhere else. America allows you to become an American regardless of your race and religion. Now, it's not perfect. Obviously, skin color does matter. But compared to other places, America is still an amazing place. And so, yeah, if some people misquote me or use me for nefarious purposes, what am I supposed to do? Say, well, therefore, I won't write books?
But as a social scientist, you've been taught, you know, not to read every data point and to take the broad view of things. And on a day-to-day basis, telling someone that, you know, things are actually a lot better for you now than they were, or your experience as an African-American in this country, you know, if you look back at the 1960s, you know, things are actually a lot better. That seems heartless and doesn't seem to hold any water for the individual experience.
Yeah. No, that's true. That's fair enough. So I understand why. And that is a, you know, criticism that people make of the book. You know, all I can say is when I survey my students, my students at NYU, I teach an MBA ethics course, and I ask them, how often do you face some sort of indignity based on your race, based on your gender? And these are MBA students who've been out in the world. They've been working in the corporate world. I give them a bunch of choices. And the overwhelming answer is either a few times, actually most of them say about once or twice a year or less than once a year. And then you talk to women who entered the corporate world in the 70s or 80s, and it's like every day. You know, they were being pinched and grabbed. And of course, that still happens. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. But, you know, every decade it's happening a lot less. Now, of course, what we're finding out is that it's still happening. So I'm not saying everything's fine. I would never say that. But if you are politically committed to denying progress, if you are politically committed to saying things are so bad that I will not admit that they're getting better, well, How can we trust you to make any kind of policy? How can we trust you to, you don't understand the situation. So whatever you're going to recommend is not connected to reality. So again, I don't want to deny your emotional experience, but I'm saying we're all going crazy by focusing on stories when in fact the broad trends are really, really good.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
I'm Andra Medea, the author of Conflict Unraveled and the developer behind C3 De-Escalation. The C3 De-Escalation Project looks at conflict as a mental health issue that affects families and people and whole communities. I'm going to lay out 5 steps so you can apply C3 De-Escalation to your family and your world. Step 1, watch out for flooding. Flooding is an adrenaline overload that shorts out the brain. You know how families can fight at the drop of a hat where everybody goes way too far? Well, that's flooding. Flooding was first identified by Dr. John Gottman, who is a specialist in couples therapy, who's become really quite the legend in terms of managing family conflicts. Flooding people don't listen. So that brilliant killer argument of yours that you have worked so hard on, that argument is actually meaningless because the other guys never heard half of what you said, and they're physically incapable of hearing what you said while they're in a state of flooding. Flooding is a physical malfunction. It's an actual short circuit in the brain. You have got to get around the flooding rather than think that you can plow through it. Step 2, large muscle action counteracts flooding. So, you're starting to really lose it around your brother-in-law. He's starting to get under your skin. Go lend a hand with the turkey. The kids are bickering. Have them run to the top of the house to bring back something from the attic. We've now found that the vagus nerve that runs through the center of the body actually controls the adrenals, and it is tied to a part of the brain that's all about the core muscles. Actions that involve core muscles will help you bring your temper down faster than, say, pacing back and forth and muttering under your breath. So think core muscles in terms of getting a grip on yourself. And think core muscle exercise if you want somebody else to cool down and start making sense again. Step 3, flooding is contagious. Flooding travels person to person. Conversely, calm is also something that can infect a family. If you get a block of the family tired and happy and working off that tension, that gives you a buffer and helps your family do better at holding off the one who is going off. Step 4, shift the brain activity. Let's say your family fights with words. Then when you go in prepared, bring visuals, because that's a different pattern than the family fight around words. Pack a bundle of family photos and have a contest. Which photo is the happiest? Which is the most swashbuckling? Who has the most over-the-top Christmas sweater? Just coming prepared with ridiculous prizes and make sure everybody wins something. Good-natured laughter is bonding, which is one of the things families need. Besides, it's a lot harder to get huffy and argumentative and on your high horse when you're laughing over dopey sweaters. Step 5, lead. Listen with empathy, equity, and dignity. Now, this is originally from Sue Rohr of the Police Academy in Washington State. It's based on listening, and if police can use listening to talk down a gunman, you can use it to manage your in-laws. Think of the things that set people off. Not being listened to, being looked down on, having their dignity insulted. In lead, you listen, but with empathy, equity, and dignity. So, let's say you can't listen to your brother-in-law's politics. It's just going to set you off and upset you and ruin dinner. Ask him about his new car or his dog. There is something that he loves that he wants to talk about and won't set you off. You can find a topic where you can listen to him that affords him the dignity of being heard. He doesn't have to be heard about his politics. You may be surprised to learn that your brother-in-law is relieved to not fight you. And he actually likes that there could be some way the two of you could get along. And I can guarantee you your kids will prefer it too.
Next up, Virginia and I speak with Anil Dash, blogger, entrepreneur, and technologist about online culture.
We hear from him about being part of an early internet pylon, how to curate a more diverse online media diet, and when it's worth engaging with a troll.
Talk to us a little bit just about your background.
So I'm a tech guy. You know, I've been in startups for like 25 years. And then about around the turn of the century, does that sound like long enough ago? You know, around 2000, 2001, I started getting obsessed with what were then the early world of blogs and social media. So people who were around back then will remember, you know, like LiveJournal and Blogger and Diaryland and sites like that. And I just thought it was fascinating. So I started a site of my own in 99. And the internet was small enough then that was kind of all it took. Like literally, if you showed up and you started writing and sharing stuff, you would get into a community and find your people. And I've stuck with it ever since. So I've been sharing on social media for about 20 years. And almost daily, I am engaged with somebody who thinks I am dead wrong about something that is not even just incidental, not like, what is your favorite song on this album? But like, you know, this is a principle and we disagree.
Right.
And that has been completely unexpected, and especially that it would be something that happens daily.
Yeah. It's changed though, right? Like over the years, like how has that experience changed for you?
You know, the very early days, I would blog about something and it was mostly strangers on the other end. And I wrote a lot about tech then as I do now. And, you know, I'm dating myself, but people can sort of relate to the same things these days. You know, it was like Windows 98 would come out and you write about it and somebody would say, you know, I think your take is too harsh, or I think you're wrong. And you know, the same happens. There's still fanboys on the internet yelling about the Mac versus, you know, whatever, or Android versus iOS or something. I don't know, whatever people debate about. So I cut my teeth on that, and it was not deeply intellectual debate, but it was sort of like, no, I have a team. It was almost like arguing about sports teams, right? Mm-hmm. And really it changed for me, and this is sort of an absurd thing to say, but it changed for me after 9/11, which was when I think a lot of us started writing about politics and policy and really big cultural issues that had been sort of not really the done thing for writing about on social media. And I remember in the run-up to the Iraq War, end of 02, beginning of 03, sort of writing about that stuff rather pointedly and having disagreement with a guy who I had previously had a lot of positive back and forths with. We'd linked to each other's work and, you know, thought, oh, we're kind of similar, geeky kind of guys. And we disagreed on politics, and he had a community. He had hundreds of fans. And it went from, you know, I think you're dumb, I think you're dumb, which is sort of not, I was not a very thoughtful political debater at the time, to sort of, and I don't think it was intentional on his part, but what we nowadays would recognize as a social media pile-on, right?
Right.
So you see this where somebody transgresses on Twitter or on Instagram, and everybody tears them apart for a day or two and then moves on to the next thing. That was not a known behavior in 2002. Mm-hmm. And so to have his, and it was probably only a couple hundred people, but at the time that seemed huge. You know, a couple hundred people came and they weren't disagreeing with my ideas. They were saying I was a bad person because I believed X, like sort of asserting things about me. Mm-hmm. I was devastated. Yeah. I remember sitting in my apartment and just feeling gutted.
Yeah.
And the stuff that played out, again, like these things are almost routine, like they're not okay or acceptable, but they happen all the time where they called my then employer and they called my boss and they said, you know, this guy's saying these terrible things online, none of which was true. you know, trying to get me fired and that stuff. And, you know, I was terrified and felt incredibly vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And it was a clarifying point for me because I don't think very many people had been through that at that point. And again, it was just being early. Like, I don't think there was anything particularly distinct about what I said or that I had some, you know, particularly bad experience. Certainly many people have had far worse since then. Yeah. But it really was so personally affecting. And interestingly, I tried to sort of rally other folks, like, can you see this thing? This is bad. This behavior is bad. This pattern is bad. And I think I didn't articulate it well. And people sort of saw it as me saying, like, I feel sorry for myself for having gotten, you know, piled on by these people who think I'm wrong.
Right.
And the response, as we still see people do today, is, well, you're a snowflake. You're being delicate. Why are you so fragile that you can't stand behind your words? And I was like, no, there's a different thing here, which is like, I'm fine about my opinion. I didn't change my opinion. I don't feel like these people bullied me away from feeling what I feel. I think that there was a attempt to sort of destroy me that wasn't even really about political point, but about sort of being on a team.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was instructive. And anyway, the end of that story is you fast forward to today and we reconnected and I talked to him a little bit about it, like, listen, I felt like I really went through something when you came after me. And, you know, he said, like, I was disagreeing with you. I didn't know the dynamics of how it worked and that was going to spark a pile on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that's completely true and fair on his part. I don't think we understood those catalysts. Like, now, you know, like, if I quote somebody's tweet,
I know,
and in my case, I try not to have my followers do that. I don't do that on purpose. But when someone does that, they're trying to, like, call them out and say, everybody go get them, sick them, right? But it was one of the formative things for me that was really, really instructive about the same lessons that we tried to learn then are 100% as true 15 or 20 years later on the social web, which is there are people on the other side. They're real humans. You have to sort of humanize behaviors. There's nothing wrong with holding somebody accountable. There's everything wrong with pursuing the destruction of someone you don't know.
Right.
Well, this ties into something that I think about a lot because one of my big self-preservation strategies online is to just not wade into arguments, you know, like I have that one cousin who I have unfollowed on Facebook and, you know, I think everyone does at this
point. I think
most
people do,
Yeah. And I wonder a lot, how can you tell when it's worth arguing with someone and you might learn something and come to some kind of mutual agreement and when they're just being a troll or when it's absolutely a waste of everyone's time to wade in?
That's a great question. I think there's two aspects of it. One is just learned experience of reading the troll signals, right? I mean, these days they fly their troll flag. They have an avatar with, you know, whatever meme of the day indicates that I'm acting in bad faith, or from their identity, from what screen name they choose, who they follow, what phrasing they use, right? And I think of, like, one of the early things that I caught on, again, probably 15 years ago was, and at that point it was not really social media as much. I think it was probably talk radio and maybe even Fox News at that point. But there was a phrasing of Democrat Party for talking about people who were part of the Democratic Party. And people within the Democratic Party, I'm not a Democrat, so, like, it was just an interesting vocal tick that I noticed where, like, people who were Democrats always talked about the Democratic Party, and people who were not just Republicans, but of the sort of strong advocate, like, hard right contingent within that party would talk about the Democrat Party. And it was a weird phrasing, right? But you see, once you hear it, you can't unhear it.
Yeah.
And I just sort of caught that because people would say to me, like, well, this is what I expect of people like you in the Democrat Party. And I'd always be like, I'm not a Democrat. But then, like, as somebody that loves language, I was like, why do you say this way? Like, nobody says this. Mm-hmm. Like, what does it signify to you? And what I realized was and this, of course, seems like a ubiquitous thing in culture now, they liked that it got under somebody's skin.
Mm.
And they were mystified in my case that it didn't get under my skin. I was like, that's not an identifier of me. So the fact that you get it wrong isn't really relevant to me. But linguistically, it's fascinating.
Right.
It was a really strong indicator of they were arguing in bad faith as trolls. And that, you know, that can be a visual, that can be a choice of language, that can be how people talk about things. But the framing, the language of things is a really strong indicator. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what you realize is, like, what you communicate and what you, you know, signal and what you state are almost parts of your identity. And trolling is, for an increasingly large contingent of the web across the entire political spectrum, a form of asserting group identity and belonging and defining the boundaries of what you're comfortable with. And then the last part of it, which is probably the simplest part, is I ask people all the time, like, really basic questions, like, you know, you can talk about the most contentious issues, and it can be, you know, abortion and, you know, white supremacy and like these incredibly polarizing issues. And people will come at me with a disagreement, and I'll say, like, can we agree on these factual basis? What do we think about X, Y, and Z? Do we think that this is what the law says? Do we think this is what our basic human rights principles, you know, whatever the sort of framing is? And if they can respond to that, you can have a conversation, actually, like 99% of the time. The people who are acting in bad faith will not respond. They will do anything to evade responding. They will call you every name in the book. That's easy to dismiss because you're like, okay, I see what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Or they will twist what your question is. But as soon as you do that, and it's funny because this is the Socratic method. This is ancient. This is literally thousands of years old. There's nothing new about it, but it's extremely clarifying.
Have the lessons you've learned online helped you in real life?
Oh, yeah. You know, biggest one is knowing when to walk away, for sure, right? You know, like there's a really clear, like, this person's not acting in good faith. You know, the biggest thing for me is, especially, and I'd say Twitter is probably the best at this, I've always in my networks pursued people that have a different context than me, different background than me, and I've learned so much about, like, people's lived experience and their perspective. Like, I didn't go to college, and I grew up in a tiny, small town in Pennsylvania, and by being around social media and being around people, I saw so much broader experience and learned so much more.
I always hesitate to use the word curate, but how do you curate your social media feeds to have this kind of diversity of opinion and have all these things filter up to you? It seems like such a big problem for most people is that our feeds are increasingly siloed, so we only see a certain type of thing, people who agree with us. How can we break out of that without also getting into circular arguments? You know, I know so many people who will like troll a flat earth or Facebook group or be in it just to see and kind of poke the bear, which doesn't seem productive.
Yeah, I don't have the energy for like going in to antagonize people anymore. I probably did at some point. You know, if I were still in my 20s, then I would probably do it. But I sound so old. The thing that I come back to is I'm very, very conscious about what I read, what I follow, and what I amplify in particular, because I'm lucky enough to have a platform. And so a couple months ago, I wrote a little script, like a little program to unfollow everybody on Twitter. And I was following, I think, 4,000 or 5,000 people or accounts. But a lot of that was like bots and things. And also I've been on Twitter since basically it existed. So you just pick up a lot of things over the time and they'll sort of be accounts that went dormant or silent or whatever. But at any rate, it's too many. It's too many to keep up with. And it was skewed. And I felt like it was sort of, I didn't need to see regular headlines. That was really stressful. And so I unfollowed everybody. And then I I followed my wife and my son and, the the account for the estate of Prince. I'm a big fan of Prince's music. And that was sort of it. And that was it for a while, for like a week or two. And then I just sort of one by two, you know, or three at a time would follow different accounts. And I'm like, I got a couple hundred now. It's a good balance. But I was very judicious about certainly, like I didn't follow any like company accounts or official news outlet accounts, like none of that stuff. It's all people. I tried to be a little more geographically dispersed. I had been pretty good for the last several years about trying to be balanced on gender. I probably still am. But I actually, that got easier because for the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, I've only retweeted and amplified people who aren't men. And that just changed my whole following behavior. Like it made me much more conscious. I'd always try to be thoughtful about like, I don't want to, you know, amplify people who are whatever, not of good intent, but to be really conscious about who created this piece of content or who wrote this story or whose voice am I lifting? And, you know, it's a little fuzzy because I think like I quote tweet accounts and those can be people of various genders sometimes. But I think in terms of like actually retweeting somebody in the way everybody's going to see it, I'd been very intentional about that. And what that ended up doing was making who I followed sort of grow into that network. And so it ended up being far more women, especially women of color. And I think as I've refollowed people, it's become that. And then that just naturally branches out into other categories. I also was very deliberate for me of like, I work in media, I work in tech, to not follow as much as that. Like I did it intentionally, a lot more historians, a lot more academics, especially in this moment, it feels like that's really important. You know, my real guideline on the whole thing was like nobody who's going to share stuff that makes me feel miserable when I see it, because there's enough of that in the world. Like they can be thoughtful and they can be talking about important issues and it's not all going to be like cheery butterflies or whatever, wholesome memes. Like there can be stuff that's challenging, but it's all going to be thoughtful and sort of grounded. And again, it's so instructive. It's taught me so much. I feel like I've gotten like a master's level education just from the people I follow on Twitter.
So this is coming out right before Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And most of our listeners have had experience on Twitter, but I think we've all had experience on Facebook, especially with, say, family members.
Oh, sure. I sure have.
High school friends, high school chums you might be seeing for reunion Thanksgiving weekend, who have political opinions that are different from your own. What can we do about those family members living in other states who we rarely see or hear from outside of their angry political rants on Facebook?
You know, I think it depends. Everybody has a different measure here. And it depends what your goals are, right? I think, you know, there are lines that cannot be crossed, right? And so when people advocate for persecution, when people advocate for hate, I don't think that there should be reconciliation. I don't think it falls into the category of like, how do I reconnect with this person I disagree with? You know, if somebody's like, I have a dispute over what the proper marginal tax rate should be, of course, like, like suck it up, sit down, pass the potatoes, you'll be fine. Right. You know, like, I don't think that's a big deal. The thing is, those things are connected now.
Yeah.
Right? There are people who will say that their rationale is, I care about taxes or I care about some other sort of, you know, trade policy or something. And if they use that to countenance injustice, I don't think you can let it slide. I think you have to address it.
Thank you so much, Anil. And I've heard you have something you want to plug.
I work at a company called Glitch Now, and it's a creative community that I think really is actually the kind of place that, you know, your audience in particular will spend their time, because it's, you make stuff you share with people online, and it's not one of those social networks that makes you feel miserable, right? You go there and it's creativity. It can be art projects. It can be little apps and tools you want to use at work, but it's a set of tools for building apps and for sharing them out. And we have just an incredible creative community. So I think it's something I hope people check out. It reminds me of a time when the internet would be a place I would go and find stuff that real people had made, not from companies, just from individual people, that was as likely to be art or a passion project or some weird creative impulse, you know, as it was a useful tool or, you know, a hack that made me more productive. Like, those things are all good. Mm-hmm. But I just love that sense of soul to it. So I really do hope folks will check it out.
And there are zero Nazis, I heard.
Zero Nazis. That's going to be our slogan. Glitch.com. Not so many Nazis.
No Nazis.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And now it's time for our upgrade of the week. Every week, we talk about that one tiny thing that's making a big difference in our lives. This week, Melissa and I are joined by Jonathan Haidt. Melissa, what's your upgrade this week?
So I've been doing some gardening in my apartment, and I think my upgrade of the week is going to, as if it weren't obvious, like, reveal me as a total city mouse, like someone who has an actual garden in their yard in a non-urban environment knows this. Maybe everybody knows this. So I have a hard time keeping plants alive, but I love plants and I feel they are essential to any healthy living environment. I recently discovered why all my plants die. That's because I had believed a myth about gardening, which is that if you have a pot and it doesn't have a drainage hole on the bottom, if you put a layer of gravel on the bottom of the pot and then put the soil on top of it, your plant will drain into the gravel, which of course is impossible because the soil is going to absorb the water and then the roots are going to rot and the plants are going to die. So I learned about perlite.
Oh, yeah.
Does everyone know about perlite?
Yeah.
I mean, I knew that there were these styrofoam-esque things in some potting soil, but I didn't know that 50% perlite would make my succulents happy and keep them dry and make all of my plants flourish. So I highly recommend 50% perlite for your potting soil mix. That's my upgrade.
So your succulents are all happy now?
My succulents are happy. All my plants are happy. I maybe acquired too many plants. Next week, I will be talking about like macrame plant hangers, because I have to build upward because I have to go into the airspace because there's no more real estate on the sills.
Very nice. John, what's your upgrade?
My upgrade of the week is that I have a lot of trouble falling asleep, and I recently discovered that if I listen to sleep stories before I go to bed, I don't have to take sleeping pills. That just, you know, wearing headphones so it doesn't bother my wife and listening to sleep stories. I use the app, the Calm app or Insight Timer, and they have meditations and sleep stories. And it's the most amazing thing. I have never finished one of the stories. I have no idea how they end because I always fall asleep before the end of the story.
So they're just real boring stories?
And they're not even boring. It's just something just about, they're made like the person, they start off reading it and make yourself comfortable. And if there's any tension, work it out. Tonight's story, you know, like the same things that I do when I'm putting my daughter to sleep.
Right.
I read slowly and calmly. Mm-hmm. And like, yeah, they do that for me as an adult and it works.
Nice.
I'll try that. I didn't know that Insight Timer had a story section.
Well, they're meditations, but they're meditations for sleep.
Oh, nice. Alice, what's your upgrade?
So I've also been a little bit stressed out, as you probably are too, because the world is garbage.
Crazy.
It's terrible. So I have a podcast to recommend. I have been enjoying lately Desert Island Discs. You guys familiar with Desert Island Discs? It was originally a radio show. It's 75 years old on the BBC Radio 4. The host is Kirsty Young. I can't do her accent. She is the most mellifluous human being ever. Basically, she interviews celebrities and non-celebrities alike and asks them what their eight tracks they would bring to a desert island, what they would be. And they could also pick one book and one luxury item. You get this amazing mix of people. There's Annie Lennox, David Byrne. Those are kind
That's
of the
a
same
huge
type
mix.
Of...
And revealing your age, too.
There's, yeah, exactly.
Those kind people of people I like.
Everybody from Annie Lennox to David Byrne.
Everyone from A to B. There's like a guy who runs a shop. There's a lot of British people, whatever, people I've never heard of. But it doesn't matter who they are. They're all fascinating, and she's great. And it's so soothing and makes you think about what music you'd bring to a desert island. And that's where I'd like to be right now. So Desert Island Discs.
What's one of your Desert Island Discs?
Birdhouse in Your Soul. That would be one of mine.
By They Might Be Giants.
By They Might Be Giants, exactly. You can hear me on the bug light switch.
Who watches over you? And I would nominate Side 2 of Tattoo You by the Rolling Stones.
Okay, that's
still one of the
cheating.
Most beautiful.
You can't do a whole song.
Oh, it has to be a track.
Oh, it's
has to be
a track. Song. All right, if I have to pick one, it'll be Worried About You, but I'll take any of them. Sometime I wonder why.
Melissa, what would your Desert Island Disc be?
I'm going to bring Apartment Story by The National.
Oh, good one. We're so disarming, darling. Everything we did
believe is diving, diving, diving.
And that's our show. Virginia? I disagree with everything you said in this interview.
I will leave the room immediately.
Get out. The Upgrade is produced by Rachel Withers. Our executive director of audio is Mandana Mofidi. Our theme music is by Slow Biz, and Brad Fisher mixed the episode.
Talk to us. Email us at upgrade@lifehacker.com or make us happy and leave a voice message at 347-687-8109.
And while you're at it, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. 5 stars, please. Follow Lifehacker on Twitter at Lifehacker and on Facebook at facebook.com/lifehacker. And you can find show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade at lifehacker.com/the show.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.